Recording going. Peace. State and local relations. Gotta finish the contact areas. And we also need to go back to here before we go to the legislative branch. Frame of government. All right, perfect. I'm gonna add some colors to these pictures. Kind of boring, black and white. All right. All right, so gave you a little brief history of what happened historically in terms of the relations between state and local governments. Originally, it was all about the local governments, but as time went by, just like what happened between the federal government and the states, the courts sided more and more with state governments over local governments, because ultimately, as Dillon's rule tells us, essentially, that the towns are creatures of the state. And with money comes control. There are a couple of contact points in particular that highlights the complete control that the states have over the towns. And of course, the most significant area in terms of is money. Anything dealing with money, the state has a right to intervene, to regulate, to oversee. The state requires valuations to take place. The state supervises budgets. Well, the budget process is all defined by law. The state audits to make sure that all the funds received were received and spent as articulated in the budget. And ultimately, towns are not allowed to borrow outside of statutory processes. In other words, the state tells the towns what they can borrow for, how they can borrow, and who they can borrow from. All right, questions? Let's see, Abigail is here. I gotta update this thing. She's not here. Interesting. So Isher is here. Marcos. He's gone again. He must have withdrawn. Actually, no, he was still in the register, so he's going to end up failing the class. She was here, but she left. And Chris is here. All right. So there are no questions? Now, by the way, I did explain how assessment works, and I gave you some details. I'm not going to ask you anything that detailed-oriented on the exam. Just wanted to just explain to it, because I'll tell you, in all my years serving in town government, figuring out how assessments happen, that's the most complicated things, because most people believe that town hall arbitrarily sets property taxes. They don't understand there's actually a very complicated system that's the result of state mandates. All right, the next area that the states have the authority to engage in is in terms of actual administration. When the town takes action, it is done in a manner essentially as kind of like being an agent of, I guess is the best way to describe it. Towns are agents of the state. So several states basically authorize the way that town employees do their job. For instance, some states directly supervise town employees in different roles. So for instance, in New York or Ohio, there are state commissions that investigate any government, town government agency that hires employees through the civil service. So police departments, fire departments, EMT, all of that is completely and directly controlled by state agencies, not the town. In Massachusetts, there is some control over the local civil service. If you want to become a police officer and work for a town, or you want to become a firefighter, or if you want to become a teacher, you can't just get those jobs because the state operates a system that establishes criteria. So, for instance, if you want to become a cop, you have to take a civil service test. If you want to become a teacher, you have to take the Massachusetts Teacher's Test. A town cannot hire you unless you provide proof that you pass those exams. So, essentially, the states make the rules. By which these qualifications are established. States also require that other positions get certification. So, for instance, to become a town assessor, you have to become a certified assessor. You have to take classes. To become a town manager, you know, you have to take a bunch of classes that show you're a certified procurement officer. In other words, you've been trained on how to engage in contracts. Everything is determined by state regulations. And if you're not qualified, you can't get the job. Questions? Crime control. Another contact area between the states and the towns is in the area of crime control. Criminal jurisdictions are established at the federal and state levels. So, for instance, on the state level, we have the Massachusetts State Police. Under state law, they have jurisdiction to engage in policing on state highways. The state police also have primary jurisdiction over instances where a homicide took place in the towns. Some of the bigger cities like Worcester, Boston, Springfield, they have their own homicide units. So if someone gets shot and killed in Worcester, generally it's not the state police that come in. Typically it's the city that handles it. But if there was to be a homicide or a death, a homicide is the killing of another person, but we'll just say an accidental death in, say, Northridge. Well, the state police would come in, and the police, state police homicide unit, would have jurisdiction, authority over that crime scene. Municipalities also generally do not have the authority to make crimes. What is a criminal act? That is determined by state statutes, state legislature. But the job of policing is mostly handled by the municipalities. So if you're going to speed in Paxton, you know, unless you're on one of the state routes, chances are it's going to be a local cop that's going to pull you over. If there's a drug investigation, we had operating in Sutton a few years back, meth lab. And the dumbass blew himself up. He was working in a garage on his property. He blew the building up. Well, that crime scene investigation was handled by our town police department. We have on 146, there's the Red Roof Inn, if you ever go 146 South. every single night, our police department is there. There's drug deals that get busted, there's prostitution that occurs at that hotel. A lot of activity. But interestingly enough, 146 is a unique corridor in that it's not part of the federal interstate highway system. So because of that, if you ever drive on 146, yes, you will see state cops, but the towns also have jurisdiction over that road. So you may see along the way, I know Sutton PD often has cruises on 146, as does Uxbridge, right down at the border. I've never really seen any Northbridge police on it, or Millbury, but Sutton and Uxbridge, they do patrol it heavily. In other states, well, it depends. New England in particular is unique in that we have contiguous municipalities. Town that touches the town that touches the town that touches the town. All incorporated. But if you go to the majority of the states, particularly the states that are in the middle part of the country, there may be a city that's in a county, and there may be villages, but maybe many of those communities are not fully incorporated. So different types of states have different methods of policing. There may be county-level police. In Texas, they have the Texas Rangers. You know, they're not the baseball team. We're talking the actual cops. You know, they're tasked with patrolling and policing all of the areas in between the cities. And in most states, jurisdiction is confined to geography. So the Sutton PD patrol Sutton, the Millbury PD patrol Millbury. The Worcester PD patrols Worcester. Although, interestingly enough, the state in recent years passed a statute that allows for mutual assistance. So it's very possible that if something happens in Millbury, cops from Grafton or Sutton may be called in to help. And the days of you being able to outrun a cop by jumping towns, that law was also changed. Now, if you, if a pursuit begins in Worcester, the Worcester cruiser, the police officer, has the authority to continue to the pursuit all the way up to the state border. But of course, as they're going, you know, that's the funny thing. I love reading the news that, you know, someone tries outrunning the police. You know, the problem is you can't outrun a radio. Oh, and they have new techniques now. New technology. One of the coolest things that I saw is they have those blast sticks that have spikes on them that now they have like rocket tubes that can mount onto cruisers. So they can just pull up next to you and shoot them out and blow your tires up. It's really cool. All right, questions? All right. Highway Patrol. I've already talked about this. Highway Patrol. But there's also the construction and the maintenance of highways. Now, interestingly enough, today, our highway system is a good example of that evolution of federalism that we talked about for the first exam. Because authority over construction and maintenance actually involves local, state, and federal
governments. And that it involved with the evolution of technology. When the first automobiles were invented and sold, towns had roads. And the roads were mostly dirt roads. There may have been some in cities that had cobblestones, but for the most part, it was just, they were old like farm paths. So as the automobile became more and more popular, efforts were made to provide paved roads within the community. But what happens when pavement in one town hits the town's border? Well, I remember being a kid. One of my favorite roads to drive on was on the Sutton side. It was Lincoln Road. I forgot what it was called in Northbridge, which is a shame because I actually grew up in Northbridge. But you used to be able to drive down the Northbridge side. It would be paved. You'd go over the causeway, and it would be kind of paved all the way up to the border. But the moment you hit the Sutton border, it was all gravel. So I used to love it, because you get up to that point and you'd like start fishtailing and, you know, feel like you're stunt driving and having a grand old time. And eventually, once you get down all the dirt, you'd get down to Central Turnpike where it would be paved. Why? Well, for many, many years, Sutton didn't see value in paving that stretch of road, so it was just a dirt road. Now it's paved because there's a whole bunch of houses up there. But ultimately, you can see the limits of town paving because the paving always changes. You might be on a road that's pristine in one town, but the moment you hit the border, you know the road's awful. Well, the reason being is one town only has the authority to pave up to the edge of its border. Well, as the automotive age continued, efforts were made to connect the state, to make thoroughfares. So states actually started creating state agencies to oversee what were called or referred to commonly as highways. Ironically, the first three states to do so, California, New York, and Massachusetts. So the states would take from the towns the authority to make connecting roads. One of the weird legacies that 99% of the residents in Millbury, Sutton, and Douglas do not know is that there's actually a state road which was originally going to be a footprint of a future highway or a route that's called the M Route. It is a road that goes from Millbury Center, proceeds into Sutton Center, and eventually makes its way down into Manchog, into Douglas. Or even though it goes through three towns, the towns are not responsible for it. We don't pave it, we don't plow it, we don't maintain it. Because the state believed at one point there was going to be a highway going that route. Instead, they ended up taking the land for what would become 146. In building an actual highway there. But it would have been very different to zigzag down to Rhode Island by going through the M Route. Beginning with World War I, that period, Woodrow Wilson administration, towns began clamoring for more money. Because as you built more highways, there were needs for greater structures than just a paved road surface. Bridges, tunnels, costs which exceeded the budgets of the states. So they began looking to the federal government. and the federal government began issuing specific project grants.
If you've ever driven on Route 15 in Connecticut,
which goes between Route 91 and down towards the Tappan Zee Bridge, there's actually tunnels at one point that go through a hill. One day I was bored, I noticed there was a sign. I actually pulled over and I read the sign. And it referenced that those tunnels were, you know, drilled through the mountain to further Route 15 because of a specific project grant that was granted to Connecticut in like 1921. The federal government had a vested interest. Because by connecting the towns throughout a city, I mean the towns and the cities throughout a state, that allowed for a greater flow of commerce. But as more and more miles were being added, more and more funds were needed. And then during the FDR administration, there was a desire for towns to be able to make requests to the federal government. The states were getting it through project grants, but in the Hayden-Cartwright Act, 1934, it opened up the door for municipalities to send a request to Washington, D.C. directly to assist in getting funding to help build roads. Many of the cities, as the cities grew in size and scope, got a lot of additional funds from the federal government. But the game changer of them all, came when Dwight D. Eisenhower was the president of these United States. 1956, Congress passed, and he signed the Federal Aid Highway Act. This law created what technically is called the Dwight D. Eisenhower National System of Interstate and Defensive Highways. Every route that you've ever driven on that has that red, white, and blue seal on it, that is part of the Eisenhower Interstate System. Does anybody know where the U.S. government got its inspiration for the Eisenhower Interstate Highway System? Beginning in 1932, the German government started creating what was called the Autobahn. And the Autobahn was built by the German military. And the standards were based on military specs. The road had to be so wide in order to ensure a certain amount of troops and tanks and other equipment could be mobilized. Well, once the Allies burst into Germany in 1945, they found that tool very useful because they literally were able to roll their tanks all the way into the interior of Germany. Well, when Eisenhower became president, a lot of members of Congress who were veterans of that war, along with the President of the United States, Supreme Allied Commander, basically decided with the growing Cold War, it kind of makes sense that we put something like that in the United States. So, our individual lanes, northbound, southbound, at a minimum, are wide enough to be able to roll four tanks side by side. The minimum width of a highway is the equivalent of a wingspan of a B-52 bomber. So that way, if there ever was a situation, we had the ability to fully mobilize our military resources anywhere in the country.
Of course, today, with traffic and all the rest, many of the roads have been expanded well beyond their original footprint.
You know, two lanes either way were enough. But now, you know, several highways have four lanes or five lanes on either side.
But the intent was there. Yeah.
So the intent for all of our highway design was so that the federal government could mobilize into cities if they needed to?
No, to move our armies anywhere in the country if there was a need. Emergency response.
But that would be the federal government, like that branch of the military, or like, is it going to be individual states, right?
Well, the states would be the beneficiary, but it was a command decision by the United States government. Because in the 1950s, we were in the Cold War, going against the communists.
So if the communists would ever attempt an invasion, we needed to be able to redeploy our resources at a moment's notice.
But here's the catch. Who paid for it? Well, ultimately it would be the United States government. And by the way, our highway system is one of the greatest construction projects ever to occur in human civilization. Currently, there are over 47,000 miles of interconnected highways. You literally could travel almost anywhere in the United States simply by driving and taking a left here and a right there.
It is currently the second largest highway system on Earth, only behind China's.
In cost, if we were to rebuild it today, it would cost in excess of $1 trillion just to build what is currently there, which would make it the world's largest public works project, just behind the Great Pyramids or China's Great Walls. Because it's so big, there's so much of it. How many bridges are there? Thousands. How can you fix them all at once? You can't.
Is it more expensive now than it was at the beginning?
100%. Proportionally.
Yeah.
Because obviously, we know today's dollar has been overinflated and is actually worth less per dollar than it was back then. But yeah, because of a lot of government regulations and requirements. Things like prevailing wage, all the environmental regulations, just make costs more expensive.
Now, interestingly enough, because the federal government created it, the federal government regulates it. So, speed limits, exit numbers, the number of lanes, the use of tolls. Those are all decided by the federal government.
I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember, but the highway numbers used to be numbered based on the sequence, the order that they were in. So if you went to the first exit, that was number one. Well, when Obama was president, Congress, and it wasn't Obama who did it, actually it was thought of during when Bush was president, but Obama was president, he ended up signing the legislation that mandated all of the states to change the numbers to be the equivalent of the miles that it was traveled, as opposed to the sequence, to make it easier if you're on the middle of a highway and there's an emergency. So if you call, they'll ask you, oh, what was the last exit you drove by? Oh, 55. Well, they know you're about 55 miles into the road and they'll be able to find you. So it was a good idea.
They also required that they were all installed it was part of like the Great Works. I forgot what the law was called, so I'm just gonna not even gonna touch that. But there was a law that had a specific name. They also required not only that there be mile markers that were installed, but also tenth of a mile markers. So if you're ever driving on an interstate highway, look to your right, you'll see mile number 12, then you'll see mile 12 and a tenth, mile 12 and two tenths. So again, it's to help basically allow a person to kind of figure out where they are in case of emergency. Interestingly enough, not all of the mileage of the interstate highway system was built by the federal government. Some of those were overlays. That's the reason why Route 90 in Massachusetts is allowed to have a name. What is Route 90 in Massachusetts called? Yeah, the Massachusetts Turnpike. Massachusetts was building that before the Eisenhower administration. Construction on the Mass Pike began in 1949. And it didn't become part of Route 90 until 1959. So because we built it beforehand, that's the reason why Massachusetts is allowed to have tolls on it. They did not actually have to seek permission. But Massachusetts was also looking to put tolls on 93, going into Boston. Also on 95, going into New Hampshire, going into Rhode Island. But the federal government said no. But they are allowed to put tolls on the bridges that are in Boston. The Zakim Bridge, the Tobin Bridge, because those are all state bridges, not federal bridges. All right, how is it paid? Well, there is something, I don't know if you can see in the back, called the Highway Trust Fund. This is a fund that's held by the federal government. And what it does is it creates a funding mechanism to pay for about 70% of road maintenance. How is it paid? Where does the federal government get the money for? The Highway Trust Fund.
Tax
on what? Nope. Nope. Gas tax. Do you guys realize that every gallon of gas you put into your car, regardless of what the price is, that the government, the state government, and the federal government actually makes more money per gallon than the gas companies? It's a user tax. But you don't know you're paying the gas tax. It does say it on the signs of the gas pump, gas tax is included. But it's built into the price. It's currently in Massachusetts, it's 49 cents on every gallon. Different states have different amount. But you don't see it. It's not like when you go at go to Target and get something that has sales tax on it. When you print your receipt out, it says how much you pay in taxes. This is a built-in tax, so you don't actually see how much you're paying. But currently, 18.4 cents per gallon goes to the federal government. Massachusetts gets about 31 cents per gallon. By the way, Massachusetts is contemplating moving away from gas taxes in putting a mileage tax on. So that way you would get, when you get your inspection sticker, it would have a tracking device that would track how many miles you drove.
and you would actually get a tax bill from Massachusetts based on how many miles you drove.
Is that because they're not making as much money because, like, hybrids and electric vehicles?
That's how they're going to combat it. But people fought the initial incarnation of the bill because it would have been a double tax if you had a gas-powered vehicle. So there is a new version that's coming through that is aimed only at EVs.
Because you don't charge your electric vehicle, right? Or do you...
I don't know. I would never buy one of those, so I couldn't tell you. But I'm sure. I just look at your electric bill or your cable bill. There are taxes built in. So I'm sure if you... well, actually, you'd probably pay it through your electric bill. But I don't know if, like, you go to one of the car chargers. Like a sales tax. I don't know.
All right, questions. Now, there was some debate within the last 10 years of Congress increasing the gas tax, but it never really got too far. But there will probably be a point when they will have to address it, because the costs of building a mile of road is higher than obviously it's ever been. Again, the Massachusetts figure, because of environmental regulations and prevailing wage, it costs approximately $325,000 per mile. So, I don't know what the solution is going to be. All right. Another touch point is education. Going back to the earliest days, men like John Adams argued that a public education system was the critical component to maintaining the republic. Again, you've had the ability to look at our Constitution. There are several references in that it's the obligation of the people to be educated, to be informed, to be attentive. Well, our system has always valued schools. But like everything, there has been an evolution. Traditionally, the running of the schools was always a purely local matter. Why? Well, the idea was, right out of the gates, that the people of a town best know the needs of the town, and thus should be allowed to control their schools, to make a school that is tailored to the needs of the community. But, like everything else, towns today could not run a modern public school without financial assistance. Our last year, so fiscal year 26, Sutton passed a town budget of $41 million, of which $25 million is consumed by the schools. Of that, 85% are salaries. But the problem is that because we spend so much money on our schools, we don't have money for other things, like running a fire department, like running a police department, like fixing the roads, cutting down dead trees. So because of that reality, many school districts take funds from state government and the federal government. If memory serves me correctly, I think of our $25 million budget, I think roughly $14 million comes from state and federal sources. In other words, in order to run Sutton High School, Sutton Public Schools, we are spending more state and federal money than we're spending Sutton money. Because if we had to rely on Sutton money alone, we could not have our school system. Where does the money come from? Specific funding measures. But here's the reality of it. Because of the need for money, the towns no longer control their schools like they used to. So, as I said previously, you want to become a teacher, public school teacher? It's the state that has the regulations that determine what you need to qualify to get certified. And it's the state that has the rules that maintains the system for you to keep your certification. The state also controls what is taught in the schools. The state controls who can be administrators. You want to be a superintendent, you have to get special certification. You want to be a principal, dean of students, you got to get different types of certifications. All controlled, regulated by the state. The state also issues mandates of things that are not paid for, but must be done. My last year on the school committee, 2014, I think it was 2014. The state of Massachusetts mandated, and I was completely against it because as a former public school teacher, I could tell you it was stupid. The state mandates that now to be a certified classroom teacher, you have to be certified to be able to teach, I don't know what they call it. It used to be English as a second language. They changed the way it was, maybe it's English language learners. Basically, you have to be able to speak to kids that can't speak English. You have to be able to teach them at grade appropriate level. Well, the ridiculousness of that, think of a school district like Worcester. How many different nationalities of kids do you think attend the public schools? And you expect a classroom teacher to be able to teach to every single different language? But it was a mandate. So teachers actually have to take, again, ESL, I don't know what it's called. I'm not trying to be offensive, I just don't know. But they have to go and maintain certification to be able to teach kids of other languages. It's like that job's not hard enough. But they don't get extra money to do it. They have to do it or they don't get certified. And if they're not certified, they can't teach. Now here's the irony. When I went to school, there was none of this in place. Prior to 1993, the towns had full authority to determine what were the qualifications of the staff and what was being taught. Now, there was a Department of Education, but the Department of Education simply provided, like, advisories, made suggestions. So this meant it was possible, if you were to, say, transfer, your parents moved, and you transferred from one school district to another, you could have missed entire classes. Because the curriculum was controlled by the town. So for instance, when I graduated from high school, I needed to take 2 years of English,
one in writing, in grammar, and another year in literature. I needed to take 4 years of history and civics. I got state and local government class 1 year. I got U.S. government class in another year. I got American history one year. And then I think I took Western civilization my senior year. I only had to take 2 years of math. I took pre-algebra 1 and pre-algebra 2. I took 1 year of science. I took physics. But I also took other classes. Home ec, I had typing, I had architectural drafting, I had 4 years of computer. But the requirements were determined by our school committee at the time. But now, today, it's the state government that determines what classes you had to take, and has been doing so since 1993. So I'm sure your high school experience, you probably had to take at least 3 years of math, if not 4. You probably had to take multiple science classes. I think you only needed to take like 2 history classes. But today, every school system is basically teaching the same thing. Well, that's a result of state standards. The measure that changed everything was the Massachusetts Reform Act. Bill Weld, Republican, was governor at the time this law was passed. This transformed education. It required equal or more equitable funding. Because previously, the cities got most of the funding. Well, this law meant that even the smallest towns would be able to get state money. This law also aimed to establish accountability. MCAS. That's where MCAS came from. Did you know that when this law was first passed, the very first group of kids that took the MCAS, 80% of them failed? Because it was actually hard. Because the original purpose of the test was to hold teachers accountable. So if you had a group of students that failed, your file would be red flagged. And you would have to show improvement with the next group of kids that you had, that they did better on the tests. But when that first, and it was a pilot group, so the kids, their graduation was not held up. But when those first results came out, all of the parents group were freaking out. All of the teachers unions were freaking out, because it was kind of exposing the fact that the teachers weren't teaching anything. And they watered down, they literally dumbed down the tests. So if you had to take the test, it was nothing like the original model, or the initial run. And then recently Massachusetts voted on it, and they've now since eliminated it as a graduation requirement.
But the intent was accountability. Some states did that. Most did not. Well, at the same time, Massachusetts was contemplating implementing higher standards in education and accountability. The federal government also began contemplating similar. But of course, once the federal government started getting involved in the 1990s, they of course linked everything that they did with funding. Because as I've said previously, with money comes control. Money comes supervision. Beginning with the Clinton administration, around the same time, efforts were made at the national level through the Department of Education, which was originally created by none other than Richard Nixon, to address the fact that you had states achieving different educational results. So the goal was to basically kind of coordinate efforts to be able to address relief to those underperforming states through encouraging reforms. One of the first efforts, which work began on before Clinton was president, but Bill Clinton initially signed on to it, was a push known as Goals 2000. Goals 2000. This was a monumental shift in the realm of education. Because the same people that were involved in trying to make accountability in Massachusetts, several of the leaders that were architects of what we were doing in our state served on the committee that produced Goals 2000. This law, if achieved, would have been monumental. It stated that it would be the mission of the United States government to ensure that all children in America, when they start school, will be able to learn how to read and write. It also called for achieving a graduation rate of 90% across the country. So, goal number one of Goals 2000, every kid that goes to school will learn how to read and write. Goal number two, 90% graduation rate. Three, students will basically take four competency exams in fourth grade, eighth grade, and 12th grade, showing that they are proficient in English, math, science, history, and geography.
I don't know. It's been a long time since I was a kid, and less time since I've been a public school teacher. But I remember my classroom kids, we'd have that standardized test, because I used to teach eighth grade. It'd be one day, here you go, here's the bubble sheet. Have at it.
Just a general competency test. Another aspect of Goals 2000, the United States would be number one in the world in science and math. Another goal, every adult in the United States will be literate. And lastly, every school in the United States, to use the modern phrase, would be a safe space. In other words, no drugs, no violence. They will be disciplined. There'll be a disciplined environment where kids can learn without fear. Ironically, there were many people, both on the left and the right, that criticized this federal intervention into government. It was unprecedented.
Never before did the federal government ever attempt to establish standards for what was, historically, a local matter. And here's the irony. All that was to be achieved by the year 2000. Didn't even come close. And by the way, just to show you how far they've dumbed things down, do you know where the United States stands in education on a global level? We're like 40th now. Well, many people argued that the reason why Goals 2000 failed was because essentially it was an unfunded mandate. There was no money. These were just expectations. So the only way to apparently make kids smarter is to pour more money into schools. In comes the next administration, the George W. Bush administration. Ironically, this bill was spearheaded by the Democrats. But there was a bipartisan support. Not all Republicans, but some Republicans signed on, including the president of these United States, Republican George W. Bush. This program was called No Child Left Behind. The primary feature of this bill, modeled on what we did in Massachusetts, was that money would be linked with a high-stakes test. Every single state had to have their equivalent of MCAS. And funding, year by year, would be based upon performance. Oh, shit, I forgot to mention. One aspect of Ed Reform, the Ed Reform Act, that if there's a district that's underperforming, the state can come in and take it over. Any of you graduate from Southbridge High School? The state took over Southbridge Public Schools and had been running it for, I think, about 10 years. I don't know if they still are. But there were some other cities and towns. The state basically fired everybody and they took them over.
Because I remember we had to park in like elementary school. Does that play into the Reform Act?
Park is a federal test. It's not a state test. But yeah, that was one of the type of things. Because that's what No Child Left Behind did. They took the idea from Goals 2000 and they implemented, like, Park was like third grade, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like third, sixth, and like ninth or something like that. Yeah, it's the same basic idea. But why? You know, the intent is admirable. If a school district is performing, you reward them with money. If a school district is underperforming, you try helping them out with additional funds. But if they continue to underperform, you decertify them. You get rid of the administration, and you take over the school system. And you work to increase the results. How do they do it? Annual report cards. Amongst all of the data that your local school system is required to share, also included the overall grades and all these standardized testing. And there would be bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. that would look on the results, and they would, you know, tie whatever the results was to future grants. Schools were expected to show what was dubbed, and I quote, adequate yearly progress. In other words, even a 0.5% improvement year over year. And of course, this law did tie failure. The feds could impose penalties, funding cuts, and
this actually allowed the federal government to come in and take over a public school. And you know what the federal government would do? They would transform it into a charter school. Now, the weird thing is No Child Left Behind became a political issue. Even though it was a bipartisan measure, again, it was mostly drafted by Democrats, but there were Republicans that signed on, the teachers' union, and that was the goal, to hold teachers accountable, because what happens if you have a bad teacher? Well, your understanding of that subject matter could be curtailed. But what happens if you allow that teacher to teach year after year after year after year after year? Think of how many classrooms are impacted. Well, the goal of this was to allow the federal government to intervene and remove bad teachers. But George W. Bush was demonized. The teachers' unions claimed that the Republicans were trying to take over the schools, and it became a rallying cry. Which ultimately allowed the next administration, the Obama administration, to take the foundation of No Child Left Behind and go even further. No Child Left Behind called for the states to make their own testing or to hire testing companies. It was all up to the states. Well, in comes the Obama administration, and they decide they are going to mandate the curricula. The federal government is going to say K to 12 what is going to be taught in every school in the nation. Now, according to the initiative, the purpose was, and I quote, to provide consistent, clear understanding of what students are expected to learn so that teachers and parents know what they need to do to help them. And additionally, and I quote, the standards are designed to be robust and relevant to the real world, reflecting the knowledge and skills that our young people need for success in college and careers. But the problem was what was being mandated in the curricula was not educationally sound. Did any of you have to learn Common Core math? Any of your schools still teach it? You're older than most of them, so you might have got it, but they might have had theirs pulled, because Massachusetts eventually walked away. I remember when they put it in, because my kids are older than you. My son came home one day with this homework assignment, that he was basically supposed to come up with a method of solving, I think it was like the equivalent of like 5 times 10. Well, under Common Core, you had to, like, instead of simply going 5 times 10 and having your multiplication tables memorized, like how I learned it, you had to be able to figure out how to break down the numbers to smaller units, adding in a dozen or so steps, and then going all the way back and putting it all back together again. And if you showed the steps, you would get full credit, even if the answer was wrong. You had that? Yeah. It's ridiculous!
And also, if you figured it out in your own way, you would get it wrong if you got the right answer.
Get it wrong! So, yeah, you figure your path to the solution. 5 times 10 is 50. Well, but you didn't do it the right way. Wrong!
And they did that because it was like, that is like the word. You've studied child's minds, and this is what's easiest for child's minds to understand math, like foundation. But, like, if you found your own way to be like, no, I understand it. It makes sense in this way. Like, we didn't want you to like learn how to do it like that.
And that's exactly what ended up happening. They didn't want individual students to use their own abilities to problem solve. They wanted everything to be in the method mandated by bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. At its height, 54 states would sign on. You know how they did it? I was on the school committee when Sutton adopted it. They didn't tell you you were adopting Common Core. They tricked everybody. And they put out what was called Race to the Top grants. So if your students were struggling in English and grammar and literature, you could apply for a grant that will allow you to use this money and go out and purchase, you know, new educational aids. Sutton, qualified, $95,000. Our superintendent's like, oh, we're going to be able to get this extra $95,000. We're going to be able to go buy these supplemental materials. It's going to be great. But of course, me being me, I asked him, Mr. Superintendent, what's the fine print? Because if the federal government's going to give you money, they have expectations. And he goes like, oh, no, nothing bad, nothing bad. Well, the moment he accepted it, my committee, we voted on it. I voted against it. The other four voted for it. And the moment we got the grant, it basically mandated now we had to get rid of our English and our mathematic curriculum and adopt Common Core. We got $95,000. We ended up spending $575,000 because we had to go out and buy all new books. And we had to give professional training to all of the English and math teachers so they could teach Common Core.
But that's how they do it. FYI, Donald Trump, when he was president the first time, got Congress to repeal the Common Core mandates. Some states still use the curriculum because of the cost. You know, if you've already spent hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money, are you going to go out and buy a whole new educational system and spend all of that money buying new books and materials and training? But it's no longer mandated. But again, the scariest thing is that some bureaucrat in some office in D.C. that if you were in school while this was enforceable, that would basically be telling the teacher to tell you you were wrong because you figured out your own way of getting the answer. To me, as someone who went and allowed that had the teachers design their own curriculum, because they were subject matter experts and they taught their strengths, it's just bizarre. But the 2000s as a whole has been nothing but bizarre. And it seems only to be getting more and more bizarre. All right, the last major area is in the area of public welfare. Public welfare. Poor relief. Now, since Roman times, every single major civilization that came out of Europe, all the way up until the 19th century, simply allowed public welfare, poor relief, to be handled by the municipal governments. Most of the charities were run by the church. But not too long ago, there were poorhouses where people would basically go live in a town or a city-run building. And they'd be able to live on the floor going to have to pay any rent. With the advent of the Industrial Revolution, places like England in particular changed the way the system operated. If you were to go to an English poorhouse in, say, 1790, you could get admission, but you and your family would be required to work in the mill that was closest to the poorhouse in exchange for your housing. So, no work, no housing. But, as seen in works such as The Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, the idea of the poor having to... Oh, by the way, there was also debtor's prison as well. If you owed someone money and couldn't pay your bills, you'd be arrested and went to prison. But of course, that was viewed harshly. So England was really the first country on earth to basically attempt to kind of ease the harshness of that old system. And the very first public welfare law was the Poor Law. Amendment Act of 1834. This included for the first time survivors' benefits, old age benefits, unemployment compensation. It also provided for public assistance for the blind. Orphans were all given assistance. Ironically, it would take 100 years before the United States did something similar. The first major national public welfare law was the Social Security Act, 1935. This law did many of the same things that the English did 100 years before. So, if dad dies and mom is forced to raise 5 children, she can apply, or she could have applied, for federal government assistance to help keep the family, as it were, in the home. And over the years, more and more federal options were provided. But even in those laws, it was usually left to the local authority to be the avenue to get those methods of relief. So, to put it another way, if you wanted to get unemployment benefits, you have to go to the unemployment office, which is in Worcester. So you go and you sign up in a state, city-run entity, and it transmits the information to the United States government. So this basically means that all benefits were not offered everywhere universally. Because what happens if you're in Kansas and you're out in the rural part of the state, and you're 5 days away? Well, actually, I suppose nothing's really more than a day or two drive. But what happens if you're hours and hours and hours away from a local city and you can't go and sign up? Well, ultimately it was what it was. But in the decades since, the federal government has increased our safety net, if it were. So today, seniors can get benefits. Survivors can get qualified to receive benefits, compensation. If you lose your job through no fault of your own, you can apply and get unemployment. All of these are financed through redistributory methods. Look at your paychecks. See how much you're supposed to make? Because you make X amount per hour, you work so many hours. That's how much money you're supposed to make. And then go through all of the different deductions. Medicare, FICA, Social Security. All that money's taken to you and redistributed to people who are collecting the benefits. Based on the idea that when you're in need, someone else is going to work and pay for your benefits. But the biggest problem, and I know I'm out of time, so this is where I'll leave it. The biggest problem that we have today is that we've reached the tipping point. And there are actually more people drawing off the system that are paying into it. Why? We have an aging population. The average age of people in our country is in their 50s. Which means, as you get older, there's not going to be enough kids working, paying into the system for you to get benefits. So my advice is, go have babies. Lots of them.
Also, there's not move up the institution, move up with people working. It's not going to have some buying power, tax power, the huge middle class in the 50s.
It's overall working population.
Yeah,
there's less people working.
Right.
Right. So the middle class is shrunk because there's less people working. Middle class,
I'm just saying,
the biggest, because I've been reading more and more about it, the biggest concern is our aging population. So all of the baby boomers, which is one of the biggest generations proportionally that's ever been born, followed by my generation, Generation X, we outnumber you.
Yes, absolutely.
So the result is that when I retire, there's not going to be enough you working to pay for my benefits. And if you guys don't have more kids, it's only going to get worse. Because the system was designed with the belief that there always would be a rising population of young workers. And that's not the case. Less babies are being born every single year. And that's going to lead us off the cliff, which isn't good. All right, my friends. Unlike what I told you on Tuesday, have a nice weekend.